Okay, when you get down to Hosea 2, verse 18 and 19 and 20, I would say those are the perfect characteristics of an ideal marriage. Verse 19, you'll see betrothed in righteousness, judgment, loving kindness, mercies, and the word forever. I say those are characteristics of an ideal marriage. And then verse 20, faithfulness. Interestingly, that is found in a chapter where his wife has forsaken him, which wouldn't be an ideal marriage. Okay, so Hosea chapter 2. Remember, as we've gone through chapter 1, Hosea was told by the Lord to marry this woman of whoredoms. Chapter 1, verse 2. And when he told prophets to do these things, these were specific signs to the nation of Israel or Judah, depending on the time period it is, because the Jews require a sign. Hosea, remember, is a prophet to the northern tribes of Israel before they became slaves of Assyria. Okay, so in chapter 2, so far, Gomer, his bride, has had three children. Okay, and their names all mean something for the nation of Israel. Now, at the beginning of chapter 2, she has left Hosea. She's gone. Marriage is busted up. Hosea is still a prophet. He is still prophesying, even though the marriage is busted up. Can you imagine the rumors that are running around on this one? You know, the man of God. It's all marriage, all busted up. Okay, so Hosea 2, verse 1, he says, "Say ye unto your brethren, Ammi, and to your sisters, Ruamah." Okay, those are the shorter versions of the names of his children. Okay, you see in verse 1, Ammi, or Ami. And then if you go up to the top, in the middle of verse 9, Lo Ammi. Okay, and so the L-O before the Ami means not my people. So when you drop the L-O, now it means my people. So it'd be like Peter and Pete, or Jonathan and John. Okay, the other name, Ruhamah, is back in chapter 1 at verse 8. Again, the L-O is dropped. Okay, and that name means not pitied, but in chapter 2, verse 2, that means pitied. It's like the word, the letter A before a word. Atheist makes it the opposite of something. Okay, so what Hosea is doing, he's asking his children, or two of them, to go to mama and try to get her to come back to me. And this is often the occurrences when marriages go south or sour, is the children definitely are directly involved. Okay, so he says to the two children, plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife. Neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts. Well, is he meaning literal? Did they get a bill of divorcement? Nothing is mentioned. Or does God view fornication in this matter as she's switching husbands? Kind of hard to say. Ezekiel talks about an agreement or a covenant between man and wife. So there is some sort of a covenant. Let's see. Malachi 2, verse 15 and 16 talks about a covenant of the wife of your youth. So there is some sort of agreement that does develop as history progresses. Now, with Adam and Eve, nothing was mentioned about a covenant. Of course, nothing about a license. Nothing about a ceremony. It's just that he took a wife. So it's just that they had relations and it made them man and wife. And the Bible implies that, but then again, how far do you take this? Remember the woman that Jesus met at the well. You've had five husbands, but the one you're shacking up with now isn't your husband, but in actuality, could be your husband. See, so there is it's kind of a tough thing to, I'd say, be hard fast on this. As time marches on from Adam and Eve, when you go through Genesis, you'll see that a man just took a wife. Nothing about agreement, he just took a wife. But as nations start to develop and more people come into the earth, then eventually there's got to be an agreement of some way, a covenant. Okay, and that's what the Bible does mention it. Okay, and so, but when does a marriage occur? At the wedding altar, when they both say, I do, I would say that's the agreement. But then it's consummated, you know, later that night. So, it's kind of a tough thing. Now, he's asking his children to plead with mama to come back. Now, this shows a little bit the attitude that the innocent party in this should try to portray. And I do believe it's a difficult thing to do at times, but I would say the one who portrayed it best than anybody is Joseph when he discovered that his bride-to-be was with child. And his attitude was, I love her, so I don't want to make her a public example, even though the Bible says I should. But I love God, and so God says I should put her away, but yet I love her and I don't want to make a fool out of her. So, and you see the turmoil that Joseph was in, and then God gave him the answer that night in a dream. But often jealousy steps in, and jealousy will increase one's hatred equal to one's love, or the exact opposite. And that's that idea of jealousy and hatred is interestingly mentioned in Song of Solomon, which is a book that deals with the intimacy of marriage. Let's see, Song of Solomon. Verse 6, set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm, for love is strong as death, jealousy is cruel as the grave. And then so forth. And this jealousy is even called a spirit of jealousy in Numbers chapter 5. So it's an unclean spirit. It's an unreasonable jealousy is what that is. Okay, now verse 2, back to Hosea. He says, lest I strip her naked and set her as in the day that she was born. Are you going to do that to her, Gomer? Now in verse 3, the next phrase will show you that this appears to be that God is speaking what he is going to do with Israel. But the words are coming out of Hosea's mouth or off his pen, directing it at his wife, but yet doctrinally it's aiming at Israel. Verse 3, it says, and make her as a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. So one of the judgments of God that he places upon a nation is a desert. If you go to Israel today, it is very desert-like. except in the northern part where they do have, where Armageddon will take place, and they've got irrigation and stuff. But it is very desert-like, but yet one day that was the most fertile place on earth. You see, in Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, all those are desert-like. Why? Because of God's judgment. So when God judges a nation, if He judges the entire nation, He just turns water off. And when He turns water off, ain't nothing going to grow. And it's going to turn into a wilderness. Okay, then he says, verse 4, I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. Okay, now, is Hosea directing this at his three children? Or is he directing this as by God, from God to the children of Israel? Most likely the children of Israel. But what a statement. People would say, a God of love wouldn't do that. Well, it depends how you're looking at it. You say, well, killing children, that's not right. Well, it says in Genesis 18, verse 25, Abraham said, shall not the judge of the earth do right? And he's talking about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and no doubt there were children in there. So when God killed the children in Sodom and Gomorrah, God did right. Contrary to what all the secular college professors will think, God did right. You say, well, how could that be right? Well, if those kids grew up, what are they going to be like? They're going to grow up to be like their parents and then die and go to hell like their parents. And so He took them out before that took place. I would say that's mercy. There was a young man in the Old Testament. I don't recall the passage where it's at, but you may remember the story where a prophet said that I'm gonna take your one son. I'm gonna kill your one son because I found some good thing in him. And all your other kids, I'm gonna let them die a slow death. See, he took the one, you know, what's a better way to die if you're gonna die? A slow death where you're starving to death, or, you know, right on the spot. Don't. You're gone. You know, it's like a fella asked a colored fella, if you had to die between a train accident and an airplane crash, which would you choose? He said, I'd take the train every time. Why is that? He says, because at least you know where you is. When you get down in a plane crash, you don't know where you is. Well, it depends how you look at it. Okay, and so you're dead either way. Okay, so the Lord says, I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. You say, well, it's not their fault. And you're right, it's not their fault. But if you want to argue with God about it, you know, go ahead. I'm not going to argue with Him about it. Verse 5, for their mother hath played the harlot. She that conceived them hath done shamefully. Of course, Hollywood wouldn't agree with that statement, would they? Hollywood would say that's an alternative lifestyle, or that's, you know, liberty, or that's the freedom, that's an adult consent. The Bible says it's shameful. For she said, I will go after my lovers. And of course, you see how that word is used. That give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, mine oil and my drink. Well, is she saying Hosea didn't give her that to her? He no doubt he did. Okay, but notice she's chasing the men. That ain't normal. You know? You see, you got a wicked society when you have girls putting up posters of boys in their room. That's a wicked society. I mean, it's bad enough for the boys to do it, but when the girls are doing it, that's a real wicked society. Because, you see, the Bible teaches that a man is the one who lusts after a woman, and that's why it tells the lady to dress modestly so the man is less tempted to lust after her. But then he tells the man, don't touch the woman, because that's what excites the woman. The touch, what excites the man, is the sight. But when you got a society, what excites the girls is the sight, that is a perverted society. I mentioned, I think a couple weeks ago about a study that was conducted back in the 1930s and 40s called the Pottinger Cat Study. Interesting study. But basically this study was a fella who paid for this all himself, so it had no outside influence. And what he did is he took one group of cats and fed them cooked meat. Two-thirds of their diet was cooked meat, and one-third was cooked or pasteurized milk. And another group of cats was the identical meat, only not cooked, and milk that was not pasteurized. So same diet, only one was cooked and one wasn't. And then he watched the generation of cats. Well, the ones that had the raw meat and the raw milk, very healthy, good nutrition, no problems. Second generation, very healthy, lived a ripe old age for a cat. Third generation, everything just kind of went real smooth. Now, the cooked crowd, the first generation developed cancer in the late stages of life. Second generation developed cancers in the middle stages of their life. And if the third generation made it, they got cancer at the beginning of their life. And interestingly, the second and third generation cats of the cooked one, the females became more aggressive and the males turned more passive. And said, in the study, said they just kind of, they didn't say perverted, but they implied, the males implied, turn strange. What do you think is going on with our diet in this country? What do you think some of these major companies are putting hormones in this food and turning the boys into sissies? You see, definitely can be done, especially when you got these type of people at the top of these major corporations. You see, I don't trust major corporations. Because often at the top, the upper echelon, you're dealing with some real evil people. And I'm not one of these liberals that hate all corporations, think they're the problem of all society. But I obviously realize that, you could take a conspiracy. If you want to check out what could be a conspiracy, go to the store and read the ingredients and see how often sugar is put in there. High fructose corn syrup. Check out the cereals. And it'll be one, two, or three right at the top. And the first one will be the number one ingredient, and the second one will be number two, and so forth and so on. And you will see that sugar, high fructose corn syrup, will be in almost everything. Uh-huh. Yeah, right at the kids' level so they can scream for them. And so, is there a conspiracy, of the diet in America? I ain't going to say yes or no, but if I had to lean towards it, I'd say no doubt, the way I would look at it. Because it makes money. I don't believe the AMA wants a cure for cancer. Make too much money. Okay, and so here this woman is justifying her sin in verse 5 by saying, my lovers give me bread and water and wool and flax, oil and drink. Well, if that's the case, I'd rather be poor. And of course, the term lovers, they don't know what love is. They haven't a clue of what love is. Okay, and this is where Hollywood has taken that term and, run with it. And, of course, we know that Hollywood people are not happy. I mean, they're fighting all the time. Okay, so verse 6, I got a paragraph mark. He says, therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall that she shall not find her paths. Okay, now that hedge there, I remember back in Job chapter 1 that when the Lord was picking a fight with the devil, and he said, have you considered my servant Job? The devil came back, well, yeah, I've considered your servant Job, but you put a hedge about him. Now that would be known as a hedge of protection. Bill Gothard writes about that sometimes, where you pray a hedge of protection around, you know, your family or your children. That's what Job did in the Old Testament. I would add in the New Testament, pray a hedge of protection around them, and then put the shield of faith around that, and then soak it all with the shed blood of Christ. You know, I'd say that would be a good threefold defense mechanism there. Okay, so, but this hedge is a hedge that will be in the way of this person, where the hedge will guide them down to a road of either destruction or box them in a corner. Can I have the cross references? Let's see, Lamentations chapter 3. This one is about the Jews in the tribulation. And if you remember seeing Sheffy, remember the Sheffy video or movie, where that one time Mr. Sheffy was going to fix that one drunk where he, you know, put him in that pan and had the trees around it where he only had one way to run and he ran right into the tree and knocked him out, you know, so... That's the idea that's being taught here as far as this hedge goes. Lamentations 3, verse 7. It says, he hath hedged me about that I cannot get out. He hath made my chain heavy. Also when I cry and shout, he shutteth out my prayer. Okay, now that's what the idea that's going on here, that the Lord will place a hedge around this person which will direct them in a certain fashion. Proverbs 15, verse 19 is another one that goes with that. Proverbs 15, 19. It says, the way of a slothful man is as an hedge of thorns, but the way of the righteous is made plain. Okay, so in Hosea 2:6, it's like the Lord saying, I am hedging or putting a hedge around the children of Israel, and this will guide them where I want them to go. Now, whether it's destruction or box them in a corner where they're going to have to sink or swim, the Lord knows. Verse 7, he says, and she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. You see, the lovers are running away from her, and she keeps going after them, and she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. Now, the sad fact about that is that often people that go through a divorce, and maybe they get remarried, they look back in the first one, boy, it wasn't so bad, you know. Maybe it was, but often the case is it wasn't as bad as they thought. Not in always, but often that's the case. Now, in this case, what Hosea is trying to do is trying to make it tough for his wife so she comes back to him. Most fellas wouldn't even want her back. But this is an example of the Lord. God's mercy is simply amazing. So she says, for then was it better with me than now. Verse 8, for she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof, and my wine in the season thereof, and will recover my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness. And now will I discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. Well, that thing is really acting up back there. Okay, so look at that, verse 9 or verse 10. And now will I discover her lewdness. Notice the Bible term there. In the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of mine hand. So he is going to make a fool out of this lady. And he's going to, shall we say, expose her. And the ones that she chased after don't want anything to do with her. Verse 11, I will also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts, and I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, whereof she hath said, these are my rewards that my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall eat them. And I will visit upon her the days of Balaam, wherein she burned incense to them, and she decked herself with her earrings and her jewels, and she went after her lovers and forgat me, saith the Lord. So you can see that doctrinally the Lord is stripping the entire nation of Israel, taking their wealth from them, taking everything from them, taking their water from them, taking their food, their sustenance, their riches, because they forgot God, verse 13. 2 verse 13. That's the problem in a prosperous society. What's America's problem? They have forgotten about God. Psalms 9, verse 16 to 17. All nations that forget God shall be turned into hell. Now that did not say all nations that forsake God. It just says they forgot God. And with all the things, the biggest problem in America is so many distractions. And people forget God. Oh, I forgot to read my Bible. You know, therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. In America we have all these time-saving devices, but we don't have time to read our Bible. You know, I've had guys in jail tell me they didn't have time to read their Bible. I just looked at them and laughed. You know? Just fooling themselves. Okay, now verse 14, another therefore. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. Now, at the paragraph mark here, it seems to jump time on us into prophecy. Okay, as far now, he's dealing with the 10 northern tribes, and they've been, quote, lost for many years. God knows right where they're at. So now he's going to allure her into the wilderness. Now, this wilderness is what Revelation 12, verse 6 talks about, where the woman in Revelation 12 goes down into a wilderness. This wilderness is known today as Petra. So prophetically, this is jumping into the tribulation time period where the Lord is going to lure the Jews down into Petra, the very few remnant, and he's going to try to bring them back to himself. Okay, and complete the covenant. Fulfill the everlasting covenant. So he's going to speak comfortably unto her, verse 15, and I will give her her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope, and she shall sing there as in the days of her youth and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. Now, if what I said so far in verse 15 and 14 and 15 is sound doctrine, we should find another clue for that, and verse 16 is the other clue. And it shall be at that day. When you find something like that in the Old Testament, that is a doctrinal reference for the second coming of Christ, known as the day of the Lord. Sometimes it says, in that day. So 16, and it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, and shall call me no more Baali. Okay, and those names, Ishi means my husband, Baali means my Lord. So it is a closer relationship. Verse 17, for I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. So the people change their names into the Baal-like names. 18, again, that same phrase, and in that day, second coming, will I make a covenant for them with the beast of the field. Okay, now there's a covenant that is mentioned, that's prophesied in Jeremiah 31, verse 31 to 34, about a new covenant that God is going to make with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34, and that is repeated in Hebrews 8, 8 through 12. Same covenant, same verses, repeated in two places. Okay, and that new covenant will be given to the nation of Israel at the beginning of the millennium. Now this one, or a part of this covenant, is making an agreement of some type with the animals, the beasts of the field, and with the fowls of heaven, with the creeping things of the ground. So what this covenant will do is it will revise the covenant with Noah, where the animals go to a survival of the fittest state, and then all the animals at the beginning of the millennium go back to a pre-Noah state, pre-flood state, into a vegetarian-like animals again. No more predators of animals and things like that. They will all be eating plant or grain. You won't have the survival of the fittest anymore. That's when the wolf can lay down with the lamb. Okay, and it's legit. That is definitely not occurring today. Verse 18, and I will break the bow and the sword. Okay, the idea of the bow, there's the mystery bow man of Revelation 6, verse 1 and 2. Now, I don't have that as a cross-reference. You could add that there at verse 18 in the margin, Revelation 6, 1 and 2, about the bow. I have the cross-references running to Isaiah 2 and Psalm 76. In Isaiah 2, that's where he's going to turn the plowshare, or the swords into plowshares. And the sword. So he's going to not have war anymore. Psalm 76 is the other place that mentions that. Okay, the bow is a reference to the Antichrist. And he says, and I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth, and will make them to lie down safely. Now right there is another obvious clue of the doctrinal time period. This couldn't be 1948. Couldn't be the Lord Balfour Declaration of 1917. Okay, so it's got to be a doctrinal time period to get our footing right. Is when the Jew can lie down safely in Israel. He can't do that today. And of course, that will occur at the word safely. I've got three cross references there, and if you go to those, you might probably come up with some more. And that safely, obviously, is a reference to the millennium. And then verse 19 and 20, as I said at the beginning, 19 and 20 gives ideal characteristics of an ideal marriage. And this will be like the marriage that God, the Father or the Holy Ghost, has with Israel at the beginning of the millennium. Jesus Christ is married to the bride, the New Testament church. Old Testament, it's God the Father who's married to Israel. And is it going to be God, the Holy Ghost, who will be married here if you follow the doctrinal regulations on divorce? I don't know for certain. Okay, but verse 19 to 20 has the characteristics, or the pure characteristics, of an ideal marriage. Verse 19, I will betroth thee unto me forever. There's one. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in judgment and in loving kindness. That's part of a good, healthy marriage. Loving kindness. In other words, gentleness. And in mercies, you've got to have mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness. And the ideal part of the marriage, and thou shalt know the Lord. As both parties in the marriage draw closer and closer to their God, as they draw closer and closer to their God, because God's like at the top, then they draw closer and closer to each other. You see, and that's an ideal situation. Interestingly, that is enclosed in the book of Hosea of a prophet whose marriage got busted up, and he gets a second wife in chapter 3. But isn't that like God? You know, one of these arguments that people have, you know, against Ruckman is that, and I've heard guys say this, I heard this guy say it from a pulpit, Ruckman doesn't even have a right to write a book, let alone preach, because he'd been divorced. Well, if that's true, you're going to have to take Proverbs out. Oh, Solomon didn't get divorced. He just added about 50,000 wives. But he didn't get divorced. He had, you know, 300, 700 wives. So if they have that attitude towards a person who's been divorced, you're going to have to take out Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Hosea. Well, what about David? Much of the Psalms, and that's not letting us know about some of the other fellows. The Lord didn't give us insight into their family life. You know, when people bring that up to me about Ruckman, you know, I don't defend him. I don't defend him at all on that. I just tell the truth. It's sad, isn't it? It's sad that that's happened. And when you throw that back in their face, then they get a guilty look on their face because they should have been praying for him instead of stabbing him in the back. You see, and I was talking to a fellow I know that's gone through this, and he told me I was probably one of the few preachers that didn't stab him in the back and helped him through his situation, and it was a friend to him. And, I mean, right after this fellow I know, a good fellow, it probably is about 2 months after, you know, his wife had left him for the third time. And he chased her and got her back 2 times. It's the third time. Forget it. After about the third or fourth, I don't know, 2 or 3 months after that, he was going to preach for a fella down in southern Indiana. And a fella said, "Your wife left you, didn't she?" "Yeah." "Well, are you going to get remarried?" If I was in his shoes and I had a gun at that time, I think I would have used it. 2 months after it, you're not even want to thinking about that. "Well, if you're going to get remarried, I ain't going to have you preach for me." I would have said, "See you later, pal. I'm gone." What kind of an individual would do that? You see, if that would happen to him, he would sure want somebody to have mercy on them and help them out. You see, the devil can't get the fiery dart in the man, he'll go for the wife. He can't go for the wife, he'll go for the kids. And you see, Bible-believing churches, we get darts thrown at us more than anybody. Why? Because we're already dead at the other places. So our children are put under extreme pressure. And, you know, there's been times on a few occasions that we could feel the oppression in our house where you could feel like a knife, you can cut it. And the oppression often isn't pointing at me, it's pointing at my wife. And because the devil don't play fair, he goes after the weaker vessel. And then if that don't work, then he goes after the kids. And so I'm telling you that as far as Bible believers go, we need to be on our knees regularly for our children. And, you know, if the devil gets a hold of one of our kids, we need to cry and pray and cry and pray and cry and pray until the Lord answers our prayer to pull them back to God. Instead of, I told you so. That was kind of the attitude they had in Colorado. Teenager go wrong out there. It was the attitude, instead of let's cry and pray for them and try to get them back to God, the attitude was, well, I knew it was going to happen. Bunch of idiots. You know, a lot of times when we say words, those words are manifested. They go out there and devils take a hold of those words and then they enact the words. And so the thing is our children and the children of this church, the young people of this church, ought to realize that we adults, we're for them. And we're going to do all we can to help them live a happy Christian life. Because I know everybody in this world's against them. And the devil would love to ruin their lives. Wouldn't that be a big notch in his belt? And so the thing is, we as parents need to really, really pray for our children. And in verse 20, the closer we know our God, the better example we are to our children. So verse 21, it says, and it shall come to pass in that day. Again, now there's a third time we've seen that phrase. It shall come to pass in that day. I will hear, saith the Lord. The implications are that when they're in the wilderness, He will not hear. And that is true. The heavens will become like brass for the children of Israel in the tribulation. Part of the judgment of God. So it shall come to pass in that day I will hear. And Isaiah 65:24 mentions that I will hear before they call. That's pretty good. So he's reading your mind. So it's like when they're praying and they're calling out to God. Say, oh, I knew he was going to ask that. Besides, I already got it coming on the way. Enjoy it. Have a good time. Okay, it shall come to pass in that day I will hear, saith the Lord, I will hear the heavens and they shall hear the earth. Boy, a pretty close connection there then. And the earth shall hear the corn. What? Like the old common saying, in a hot July when you get a lot of moisture, you can go out and stand in a cornfield and hear it grow. That'd be literal in the millennium. Because we grow a crop once a year. You know, sometimes they try to put a double crop in, you know, like for wheat and soybeans. But in the millennium, they'll grow a crop 4 times a year. At the beginning of every season, and it says, the reaper shall overcome the sower. And that corn, you're going to hear it grow when you sit out there. And I ain't talking about hearing the ears. I mean, it's going to grow. Yours shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel. And I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. See that? This person, when they were out of fellowship with God, did not obtain mercy. And then he says, and I will say to them which are not my people, thou art my people, and they shall say, thou art my God. Okay, so verse 23. As far as God's relationship with the Jew today in the church age time period, technically speaking, because they're lost, they are not His people. Because they're lost. They are children of Adam, children of the devil, children of disobedience, children of wrath. But doctrinally speaking, the nation of Israel or the Jewish remnant, they will be His people, and they are the ones that get the covenant at the beginning of the millennium. And so when, you know, remember a few years ago, somebody asked Jerry Falwell about the Jew, and several years ago, and then he back then said, well, they have to come to Jesus Christ to be saved, and the news media jumped all over him for that one, then he backpedaled. And he shouldn't have backpedaled. They do have to come to Jesus Christ to be saved, as everybody does in this age. See, now in the millennium, they'll see Jesus Christ, and it's going to be a different dispensing of God's grace as today, and the new birth will not be in effect anymore, because that is specifically New Testament for the bride of Christ. So he said, "Thou art my people, and they shall say, Thou art my God." Okay, personal relationship with the Lord. You got a couple cross references you can run on that. Okay, that's chapter 2. So it's about 10 till. I think I just heard a tape kick off. So, perfecto. Any questions or comments are we covered? Brother Bill?